You're listening to The Daily Digestionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
And welcome to the Daily Traditionalist. Today's date is Wednesday, March the 29th, 2017, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. We are hoping to have Matthew Heidmark back on Friday. We're hoping to have him back hosting the podcast, but until then, you've got me. And today, I'm very pleased to welcome Florian Geyer back to the Daily Traditionalist. Florian, how are you doing?
Doing very well. Glad to be into the thick of spring, as I mentioned last time, but it's an honor to be back on.
Yeah, it's a little bit miserable here. It's raining, so it's good to hear that you're still full of the joys of spring. I've got a bit of a, well, I suppose it's sad and it's a bit joyful. But the first part of the podcast, I think we wanted to talk a little bit about the amazing orator Jonathan Bowden. One of the, yeah. He was just a complete nationalist hero. He excelled at just about everything that he did. And it's been 5 years since he unexpectedly passed away from a heart attack at the age of 49. And yet he is still a huge influence on people to this day. I guess we're very lucky that so many of his speeches were actually recorded, and you can find them on YouTube. And we also have 40 or 50 of them, I think, at aaronbootlegs.wordpress.com. But I just wanted to start the podcast, really, by drawing people's attention to him. I'm sure most of our listeners are aware of him. And maybe we could do a little bit of a history of the guy. I mean, there are, when he was about 10 years old, he was writing his own comics, and not the sort of drawings that you would expect a 10-year-old to do. Comics that were up to the standard of graphic novels, and he was writing these at the age of 10 or 11 years, and I believe he had some kind of scholarship grammar school that he went to, and then he went to the Conservatives and he tried to become a part of the Conservative Party. He was a part of the Monday Club and some of these offshoots. And unfortunately, they really didn't see the genius that they actually had there. And he ended up leaving the Conservatives, and he joined the BNP. And Nick Griffin set up a special cultural post for him so he could be a cultural officer. And of course, he ended up leaving the BNP as well. And he did a lot of work with Counter Currents and a lot of speeches for the forerunner for the London Forum. I think that used to be called Iona. And his speeches that he gave, they were all off the cuff. He didn't have notes for them. And this guy would just be able to speak for 45 minutes to an hour. And watching him is like, it's like watching a performance. It's really riveting just to see him. He was so visual, as well as the amazing things that he was talking about. He was so on the button, talking about Islam and immigration. He was really ahead of his time. And it's so sad that he isn't here now. And what happened was, somebody else by the name of Jonathan Bowden was exposed as a paedophile, and this was a famous paedophile case. And where he had the same name as this paedophile criminal, he really couldn't cope with this, that this was in the papers, that there was this Jonathan Bowden paedophile, and he would get mistaken for this paedophile, and it caused him to have a nervous breakdown. And he was never quite recovered from the nervous breakdown, and he just tragically had a heart attack when he was 49 years old. And he's probably one of the most influential figures that we've had in British nationalism, not just in the last 10 years, but in the last, well, since nationalism began, really. And so everyone I know has name checks Jonathan Bowden and his speeches. I have yet to meet anyone in nationalism that hasn't been influenced by him. A particular favourite of mine was his speech that he gave on Punch and Judy, talking about the history of Mr. Punch and the history of these puppet shows and the anti-Semitism that's actually in that, and the anti-Semitism that's embedded in a lot of the folk tales in Britain, and also Tintin and De Grel, where he talked about Leon De Grel and the links with Hergé's Tintin. He's just an all-round absolute diamond geezer. I don't know if you want to add some comments on this before I play a little clip of him speaking, Florian.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm very glad to have the recount of his history. I mean, he is an incredible orator, and it had a profound effect on me personally. I've listened to, you know, probably a dozen or two dozen of his lectures, and they're just, I mean, they're really excellent. He was a man of impressive character and, I mean, real power in terms of his spoken word. And that, in my opinion, you know, the Romans believed that the orator was the highest of all of the art forms, because this was the most, with your voice, you can change the souls of people. You can direct them in whatever way that you want them to go. And so Jonathan Bodden, for me, he represents kind of the best aspects of that kind of Western oration tradition. And, you know, nothing but respect for his work. And I confess that my ignorance of his history, you know, perhaps is a black mark on myself, but I'm pleased to be on and discuss him with you today.
Yeah, he's an absolute genius. I believe Alex Kotarjik is writing a biography of him, so that we will have a proper biography, because there's a piece on Wikipedia, and it really doesn't tell you very much, and Metapedia seems to be down. I think the best way of learning about him is to check out his speeches and check out what he had to say. And he was a filmmaker, an artist, an author. And each of these, like his artwork, was completely different to what you would expect it to be. And his books were quite different. And the speeches that he gave, some of them would be about people like Heidegger or famous authors, nationalist authors. And other speeches would be about the state of the country, the state of the nation. Others would be about the war. He did a particularly memorable one on Savitri Devi. And the guy [S2] Yes. [S1] Was just so well informed on everything.
Yeah, indeed. Savitri Devi is a particular favorite speech of his for me. And as you say, I mean, the thing that strikes me when you listen to him is that it's the depth of his character and of his intellectual ability, and that he's able to express it so eloquently, is that its power is really, for me, what I think of when I think about Jonathan Bowden and his speaking style and his character. Just immense gravitas.
He has a unique tone to his voice. You know, I just think of him as the archetypal eccentric Englishman, really. And it's such a shame that he's gone, because he really should have been leading a political party. The Conservative Party really, really, really missed out by not seeing what he had within him, I think. But I've got a clip that we can play. It's about 2 or 3 minutes long, and unfortunately, it's got a little bit of music backing with it, because I took it from YouTube. I had a look at a few clips last night, and I thought this was probably the best one, and it's also to do with some of the subjects that we've been talking about on The Daily Traditionalist, and particularly on the episode that we recorded last week, Florin. So I'll just press play on that now. You should be able to hear it along with the listeners. And sorry about the music in the background.
What do our people believe in now? Christianity has collapsed. Vast stretches of our population know little of our history, little of our art, little of our architecture, little of our law, little of our science. On the most conservative figures, 3.25 million abortions since the late 1960s. And they would say to us, it's just another symbol of your decadence and of your decline. If you don't want family life, if you don't want children, if you don't revere and honour them, we will replace you. This is what they're saying. And many of our people seem utterly blind to it in all circumstances. And there is a degree to which, and this is true of quite a lot of rightist and perennially minded people, and I'm not for the subject of perennial, but many right-wing people are, actually admire elements of Islam for their belief, for their strength, for their ferocity, for their knowledge of who they are. Because unless we begin to recover as a people and as a nationality and as an ethnicity, a sense of who we are and what we have achieved and what it means culturally, and until we reignite and reanimate forms of belief and consciousness in who and what we are, and when we stop being afraid, because fear and risk aversion is endemic with our people at the moment because they're moderately comfortable, many of them. People perceive life differently because they are different. Because all groups and all individuals aren't equal. Because hierarchy is endemic. Because everything is based on nature. And if you go against nature, it will sweep you away. If you build a city on a floodplain and don't have any dams, it'll flood it out. If you begin your married life in a urinal in Manchester, you will die of a sexually transmitted disease. Nature will destroy you over time if you go against its norms, because all are rooted in it. And it is only when people realize these verities and realize that they must come forward to speak for them and to incarnate them that we will revive, because we will revive. It's inevitable, otherwise we will completely disappear.
Quite amazing stuff there. A lot that he brought up just in that small clip, I think, talking about Muslims and the strength they gain from their faith, how we've lost our faith, how we've lost our idea of who we are, how we no longer go along with nature's laws, how we have a fear, and we have to get over that fear. And I think a lot of that, even though he identified as a pagan, he didn't identify as a Christian, I think a lot of that is down to us losing our faith. If we have a faith, then we're not going to be afraid anymore. We're not going to be afraid to die. If we have a faith in Christianity, then we have a link with the last 2,000 years of our people. We know who we are. We're centered in our culture. And if we adhere to nature's laws, then again, that's Christian law, basically.
Precisely. Yeah, I mean, it's a really incredible little snippet there. I mean, I think he touches on a few very, very important things. And this is the biggest thing is that, well, you know, listen, guys, our enemies have a fervent and weaponized religion, which is not only able to support their own civilization, but they're able to export it internationally and with an explicit goal of world conquest and domination, that all of the earth might enter into the Dar al-Islam. Now, and so, I mean, the thing is just the, I come back to it, there's been some talk recently in the far right, the alt-right, about, you know, what's the place of Christianity in our movement, and, you know, I think we're, ironically, Jonathan Bowden and Richard Spencer had a somewhat of a relationship. Richard Spencer said recently that, you know, the fallibility of Christianity was that, you know, if it essentially... It was able to survive without our people, and just even to without even going into this, I think that this notion that our people are going to survive without a soul, without a spirit that's transcendental, that holds them together, is absurd. And the problem that we run into is that these people who propose alternative systems, they're completely fabricated. You know, a utilitarian species of paganism that tries to massage our current political needs is not going to work because it doesn't afford people a system of ethics and of metaphysics that's transcendent. And what I mean is that, you know, people are not going to die for fabricated poetry. People are going to die for something that they believe is worth death. And this is what the gospel means, evangelion in Greek. This is the news that of a victory. And the victory is that Christ on the cross has conquered death. And so, I mean, we get back to this. It's just, it's that, exactly. If we fail to adhere to natural law, whether we're Christian or not, and Christianity is certainly a religion based explicitly on natural law, we will be destroyed by our enemies. And that's the long and the short of it.
Well, that's what brought a lot of the natural philosophers to Christianity and confirmed Christianity for them, which was seeing the laws in nature, seeing the logos at work, and their logic dictated to them that this had to be true. Christianity had to be true. On top of all the eyewitnesses and the reports that we have, and the people that were prepared to die rather than to recount, people that actually saw this going on, I mean, that there's more evidence for Jesus Christ being alive than there actually is for Caesar, because we have these eyewitness reports. And if I heard you right there, you were saying that Richard Spencer said that Christianity would survive without white people. I don't think that's true. Christendom certainly couldn't survive without white people. Christendom is Europe, European white people. That is Christendom. And I think if we look at the other nations that have taken on Christianity, when they don't have white people there, white people to look up to, and it descends into things like voodoo. They may call it Christianity, but it certainly wouldn't have the same form that it has with white people. And we have shaped Christianity over the last 2,000 years into what it is today. And now that we've turned our backs on it, we're just being walked all over by everyone, and particularly Muslims, particularly in that news story that you wanted to bring up today, I think, Florian.
Yeah, I'm going to mention one thing, and then we're going to go into this news story. Tomorrow is the Julian calendar feast of St. Patrick of Ireland. And one of the things is that he mentions how little our people know of our history. One of the reasons that Christianity was so explosively popular in the British Isles is that when St. Patrick and St. Hilary of Poitiers and St. Martin of Tours and their disciples came to the British Isles, that many Celtic and Pictish druids and other religious men adopted the religion wholesale because they believed it to be the fulfillment of their own folk ways and traditions. Right? Even in the Celtic religion, you know, even had a conception of God in terms of threeness. And so it was a matter of course for them to accept the gospel and the Holy Trinity. Now, this is kind of move us into the next thing, is that one of the cross for Christianity, you know, is a symbol of victory. Christ on the cross is a victor, not a victim. He says quite explicitly in the Gospels that nobody takes his life from him, but he lays it down. It's because on the cross, Hades, death, enveloped God. And God destroyed death. And he descended into hell and liberated the souls that had been trapped there by the jaws of death and by the evil one. This is the apostolic message. This is the good news. So going on to the story, this is from thecollegefix.com, March 27th. The byline here is, Christian student suspended after challenging Muslim professor's claim that Jesus was not crucified. A student says that he was suspended from Rollins College for challenging his Muslim professor's anti-Christian assertions, including her claim that Jesus' crucifixion never took place. 20-year-old Marshall Polston, a sophomore at the private Florida-based four-year college, said that the professor of his Middle Eastern Humanities class also told students that Jesus' disciples did not believe he was God. Now, I mean, I can get into this, but I want to get your take here of Spanish immediately.
Well, I agree with you there. I mean, that's fact. I mean, there wasn't any battles fought between Christianity and the Druids, and the Celtic Church was the first church. It had been in Britain for 200, 300 years before Augustine arrived. And they went out and they met St. Augustine, and they had talks with him, and they said, well, we've been Christian for the last 300 years before Rome actually acknowledged Christianity. So why should we pay any higher obedience to you than we do to our own Christian bishops, basically, is what they said. And this is recorded, so that shows you that Britain had been Christian for a long time. There was no records of any martyrs apart from when before Rome was Christian, and it martyred these Christians, but they would rather die than actually turn their backs on their faith. And I think that goes back to the eyewitnesses that saw Christ risen from the dead. I think there was about 20,000 of them, they said at one point. And you have the Gospels, the witnesses in the Gospels, the apostles that went out.
More precisely.
Their disciples.
Well, this is what the core of the Christian religion is. I mean, that's what martyr means, is it means witness. And if you read the Gospel of John, this is what it says explicitly in the first chapter, is that this is witness testimony. That John the Baptist and the evangelist both came to bear witness to what they had seen and were giving their testimony before the world. As if it was a trial. This is the main theme of this gospel. And so the very essence of being a Christian is that you believe the witness testimony of the apostles who saw these things, and you yourself witness to this truth, even unto death. That is what it means to be a Christian. This is why martyrs go to heaven immediately if they die witnessing to the faith, because this is the most important thing that you can do. And so, but this is, well, of course, this is typical, right? I mean, this is what Muslims believe, is they explicitly, they believe that Jesus was not actually crucified on the cross, but rather it was Joseph of Arimathea who had helped him carry his cross, and he tricked the Jews, and Jesus really was taken up bodily into heaven. And Muslims actually believe that when he comes back, he's, you know, the Mahdi, he's going to, you know, break all of the crosses and these sort of things. And so this is explicit. All of these, so many of these early Christian heresies, docetism, which is the idea that Christ didn't have a physical body, I mean, etc. These are all Gnosticism. These are all based on the idea that Christ was not actually crucified. And even when you later get into these Christological heresies, like Nestorianism, etc., that try to separate the divinity and the humanity of Christ, these are all set up in order to separate the fact of the crucifixion from the person of Jesus Christ, and to separate the divinity of the Logos, the cosmic order, from the person of Jesus Christ. And they cannot be separated. And so this is what it comes down to, is that, I mean, this is just kind of indicative of the kind of the raw cultural imperialism that's occurring in these Western countries, where this core fact of the Christian religion, what it's all about, the victory that Christ has given to us, the final victory over death, which liberates us from the grip of sin, which is ultimately what causes death, what brings it into the world. This core fact is obfuscated in these, liberal universities and colleges. And just, indeed, I mean, please, Sven, add your commentary. I could speak on this without end.
Well, I think it's very important what you say there about it being a victory and not a victim. That is a really important thing to remember.
Yes.
And I think one thing that people forget is that they weren't writing fiction back then. They took it very seriously.
No, very seriously.
Whatever your word had to be true. And if you look in the Old Testament, sometimes people say things by mistake, and they can't take that back. They can't take back that blessing or that curse. That just can't be done. Once something is said, that's it. So the idea of lying was completely alien to them. The idea of making something up, pretending to have witnessed these miracles occurring, that just, the thoughts wouldn't have even entered their heads to do something like that. Never mind the fact that all the accounts actually tally up. They tally up not exactly, because if everybody was supposed to be watching something and they all gave an eyewitness account, it would all be slightly different. It wouldn't be exact. If it was all exactly the same, it would be suspicious. And I think what the Muslims did, they took something, I think it was from the Gospel of Barabbas or something like that. And it was Simon of Cyrene. And in that spurious gospel, it said that Simon of Cyrene, that was carrying Christ's cross, he was substituted in his place.
Yeah, sorry, I got Joseph of Arimathea mixed up with him, as you said.
And I think, what's going on with this college, they're just bending over backwards for Islam, basically. I mean, they're really, really going after the Christians. At the end of the article, it talks about how the Christian groups there have been kicked off campus for having conservative beliefs. They've had their funding pulled. They've been told that if they don't allow non-Christians into leadership roles, they won't get any money. Can you imagine Islam allowing non-Muslims to be imams or to have leadership roles? They've been told they're not allowed to have private Bible study in their dormitory rooms. I mean, this goes further than kicking this guy out just for pointing out what the Christian, well, what the tradition is, what the eyewitness reports were. And the college just appears to be putting up with this. I mean, that they've kicked the young lad out. And
yeah,
nobody's
standing
up for him.
I mean, and this is, it's incredible. And I mean, it's one of these things that never ceases to amaze me is that, you know, this kind of totalitarian culture that has emerged in the United States education system. From primary school to tertiary education, and but this is what it's all about, right? Because it's about the formation of the worldview in the youth, where you indoctrinate secular liberalism, you know, enlightenment humanism into them, and you get them, you know, into the system. And this is that's the thing. If you control the language, if you control the presuppositions that they operate on every day as true dogmatic fact, you can control exactly what they think and exactly what they do. And this is why what we're doing is so important, you know, not to jerk ourselves off here, but it's just to say that to give the traditionalist viewpoint is so necessary and radical in today's day.
Well, it's just accepted as fact. For the last 2,000 years, or up until last century, it's just all accepted as fact that Christ died on the cross and he rose again.
Yeah, precisely. Well, going back to the subject, yeah, I mean, it's incredible, these people. You know, of the 11th of Christ's apostles who were present at Pentecost, 10 of them died violent deaths under torture. Only one, John the Evangelist, died peacefully. Every other one was tortured and died because they refuse to recant their testimony and their witness to Christ. It's a matter of record, of historical record, of the endless Christian martyrs of the first 300 years of the church who suffered, you know, excruciating tortures and martyrdoms rather than recant their witness that, yes, indeed, Christ died on the cross and he was resurrected from the dead, and Christ is the Logos of God. He is the second person of the Holy Trinity. And so, you know, it's incredible. Some, you know, these people who make this assertion that this was, you know, not ahistorical, that this didn't really happen, that people made this up. It's just absolutely baloney, you know. And so, I mean, it. And then, anyway, we could go on this for a long time, but I just want to kind of bring it back and come down to it. This is why for Christians, like the cross is the symbol, because this is how he has overcome the world. And this is in Western Christianity, starting with some errors in Catholicism and this, you know, Protestantism inherited this, is they turned the Christ from a symbol of victory to the symbol of victimhood, where, you know, Christ is offering himself as a sacrifice to expiate the sins, to forgive, you know, all of the sins of mankind, which is true. But it doesn't just stop there. It's not just simply a redemption to the place where Adam existed. It's a surpassing of this. Because by his death, he has destroyed death. And by his resurrection, he has brought us up from Sheol, from Hades. And by his ascension into heaven, he's shown us the way that we can also, through baptism, become adopted sons and daughters of God. This is what the Gospel of John is about. It's about the creation of children of God. That we become sons and daughters of God by divine adoption. This is what Christianity is about, theosis, to become like Christ. Christian means little Christ.
It's a shame.
So to deny the cross, yeah, and I'm just sorry to get back to the point. So this is why all of the, you know, Islam and all of these other heresies, etc., they deny the cross. Because if you deny the cross of Christianity, none of this matters.
Yeah, it seems like Protestantism has kind of concentrated on the suffering bit, suffered on the cross.
Well, they inherited that from Catholicism. This is something that started in the Middle Ages, was a particular devotion in Western Christendom to like the suffering and the physical, you know, humanity of Christ. And it's not to say that it's wrong to think about that, but it's when you exclude the victory and the resurrection that's implicit in his death.
It's a victory over death that is important. I think that's an important thing for us now to think about. I mean, conquering death, that's the ultimate victory. And we're assured that we will have victory with him, good over evil, and triumphing over death. And it says in the book of Revelation that he will destroy death once again in the apocalypse. Death will be finally destroyed once and for all. And he's shown that will happen because he conquered death. And then at the end of time, you get the death is destroyed once and for all for everyone. And that's what yes. we are assured. And these are witnesses that saw him rise again from the dead. And all our ancestors went along with that, and they honored that, and they respected that, and they fought and died for that, following in the example of these marches. And yet here we are today, 2,000 years later, and we're putting up with people in our colleges kicking Christians out for repeating what their ancestors said. And we've got people in white nationalism that mock Christianity and mock the religion of our forefathers and claim that it wasn't the religion of our forefathers. It was. It evolved from their earlier beliefs into Christianity. There was very, very few problems with it, certainly not in Britain. Possibly in the Baltic states, and one incident of some pagans getting massacred by Charlemagne. But that's it. That's all there is. And that was a political massacre more than a religious one.
Precisely. And that's the thing. And so anybody who denies this, I mean, this faith is built on the blood and bones of our ancestors. That's who we stand upon. And so to deny this, to deny Christianity, to deny the cross, is to piss on the last 1,700 years of blood and bones of our ancestors that built this civilization. And so, I mean, this is the thing, is if you are interested in Western civilization as it has existed for the last 2,000 years, then you have to be interested in Christianity.
Yeah, I agree. It's all about honoring your father and your mother, which is honoring your race and honoring their traditions and their wishes and the way they were. Florian, I'm sure we could go on for much longer, but we've got to finish the podcast. So I say thank you very much.
Naturally.
Thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. And it's a good job we've been talking about Christ the Victor, because I'm now going to say Hail Victory.
Hail Victory.
You've been tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArian.com.